If you want to grab your Bible, we're going to have a look at a couple of different passages this morning. But we're going to continue in a theme that we have been in for the last 3 weeks. And we will continue this week and then two more. If this is your first week with us, it's my pleasure to welcome you. My name is Tim, and I just love that we get the opportunity to gather together from so many different places. And really, I don't want to just fill the morning with talking at you. I find whenever I prepare messages that I find myself very challenged at the same time. And this series that began, probably birthed in my heart a couple of months ago, I just find continually challenging. And we birthed this with this theme that I asked the question weeks ago, is it us that pursues God? Or is it God that initiates that pursuit? And if we look at the Bible from the beginning to end, God initiates pursuit with mankind. From God searching out Adam and Eve through to our own stories. And then this picture that was on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel that is God's creation is really the theme of it. It's God's creation of Adam. But when I was really, you know, this picture's captivated me for some time, but here I was looking at it, and just for those that may have not been here at the beginning of this series or have missed the initial part, there's an incredible difference between the two images. And one is of God who's, if you're not sure, it's this one over on this side, is how Michelangelo illustrated God. And, you know, the angels virtually restraining him in heaven, you know, supporting him so he doesn't, like, fall out almost. And the intentionality in his face and in his arm as he extends towards man, and then man's repose and response is just this, you know, if you can come a little further, you know, maybe we'll connect. And this is really the theme behind this series of messages. And it is about our intentional response to God's pursuit of us. And there were five topics specifically that I took on. And if you've missed any of these, let me encourage you to go back and listen to them. They are now online. All right, if you need a pen to write it down, there's no www involved in the address. All right, it's just your HTTP :// Then type this, Good Life Budrum. All right, Good Life Budrum dot Podbean. podbean.com. All right, that's where you can catch up on the messages. Really, if you missed either the first one, which was on intentional response to God in worship, or last week, intentional response to God in prayer, go back, have a listen to them. And then that'll sort of bring you up to speed on some of the topics. So the five themes we're covering are these. Intentional response to God in worship and praise. Now, I haven't got time to recap it, but if you haven't been here, it's not what you would initially think, that I'm just talking about singing. Intentional response, secondly, in prayer. And prayer, I went back to Jesus' prayer that he taught his disciples that was an intentional response in dependence upon God, not just my declaration of all that I would do. Today we're going to talk about an intentional response in serving. Again, taking it outside of the walls of this building. And then in the next 2 weeks, I'll be covering intentional engaging with one another and intentional pursuit of others. So they're the themes that we're going to be covering. And if you go to 2 Chronicles, there's just a wonderful verse there that says, the eyes of the Lord roam or range throughout the earth, looking for those whose hearts are towards him, that he might strengthen them. All right, that's really the theme. If you can get in your head this idea that God is continually looking for people who will respond to him, that will turn, you know, their face to him, and he then strengthens us and enables us. All right, I need you all to shut your eyes for a minute. Everyone's eyes shut? Good. All right, you can open them again now. Sorry, I just had gum in my mouth that was tangling with my tongue. So I had to take it out. All right, let's continue. I know you're waiting on like this little spiritual moment. Something's going to be really like, I just had to spit my gum out. Matthew chapter 20. All right, let's go there. Matthew chapter 20, and we're going to be in verses 25 through 28. In fact, I'll take it back to 17, if we can. Matthew chapter 20, beginning in verse 17. Now, as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside, and he said to them, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. And they will condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And on the third day, he will be raised to life." Okay, just pause in that moment. Jesus just declares to his disciples, this journey that we're now walking, this is where it's all going to culminate, in my crucifixion and my death. And I can imagine maybe some of the questions and the weight and the things that are happening, but as you read on, verse 20, it says, then, or at that moment, the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. "What is it that you want?" he said. And she says, "Grant me that one of these two sons of mine might sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." That seems really an out-of-place question with what Jesus has just said. So the context is they're headed towards Jerusalem. Jesus says, this is where it's all going to come to the climax with my crucifixion, my death, my flogging, my betrayal, the whole thing. And then James and John's mum comes and says, I know you're entering your kingdom and all that's what's coming, but can my two sons have the most honored positions in heaven? Doesn't that seem a little out of place when you set it in the context there? Jesus goes on to say, you don't know what you're asking. Can you even drink the cup that I'm about to drink? And the two gallantly answer, of course we can. Yes, we can. And Jesus just says, you'll indeed drink from the cup, but that's not for me to grant where you'll sit. And then in verse 24, and we go on from there, it says, when the 10 heard about this, the other 10, which out of interest also included Judas, who was about to betray Jesus and has purposed in his heart what he's doing. When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant. They were upset. Now, when I was reading back through just the setting of that question, can we be seated at your right and your left? I thought, man, I'd be indignant too. I'd be like, were you not even listening to what Jesus just said? But even more so, I'm wondering what's going on in a mum's heart that she would sort of push in that moment. And I wonder, you know, if she's been thinking about this and the boys have been talking about it with her and wondering how important a place they can have alongside Jesus when he enters his kingdom, and realizing that, man, it's all coming to the climax and it could come to an end. Do they really sort of think maybe this is the moment we got to make our move? I mean, we might not get another opportunity. And if we want our appeal to be heard, and if we want our position to be secured, and if we want our appeal to, you know, reach some good end for us, we better make our move. I know it's a little uncomfortable, but heck, if we don't do it, we might not get those slots. Someone else might. And the first thing that this stirred in me when I was reading about it is I asked myself, I thought, man, how often do I need to check my own motives? What's pushing me? What's behind my moves that I might make, or the questions I might have, or the actions that I might take? Because Jesus, in this very setting, goes on a little further. And he says here, he calls them together, and he says, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. But in verse 26 of Matthew 20, Jesus says this, not so with you. Or don't let it be like that with you. Don't try and secure position and get authority and control other people. He says, instead, whoever wants to become great must become your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be the slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Jesus says, just as I didn't come to this earth to state my position, to secure my importance, I came to serve. And if you want to understand my heart, if you want to inherit a place in the kingdom of heaven, if you want to somehow get ahead, then start serving. And that's why the theme, the third section of this, is this: be intentional in serving. Be intentional in serving. So I go to that first point again, which is this: we must learn to check our motives. Is what we're doing about my own recognition, or is it ultimately about God's glory? Is what we're doing about my own recognition? Now, some people serve and they will put themselves in the front of people by serving, but their motivation is to be seen. And it's a twist on what the servant heart really is about. Jesus says, I didn't come to just make my name great. In fact, if you look at Jesus throughout the Gospels, there are many times that he performs miracles. He feeds, he heals, he delivers people from demons, and he goes, shh, don't say anything. Don't go back into town toting my greatness or who I am. My time's not even at hand. Just leave it quiet. I wonder in this earth how many times we, if we had a gift that, you know, God gave us and he said, hey, I'm going to use you to do some great things in this earth. I'm going to use you and my power in you. I'm going to allow you to pray, to heal people, to restore people. I'm going to allow you to go and speak wide and far abroad in great places. I wonder how many of us would go, that is opportunity. For my name to become great. And I wonder how much that temptation would creep in and become the motivation behind the exercise of the gift that God entrusted to me for His glory. And I found this really challenging because I know my own heart gets twisted pretty quickly. You may have heard me share it before, but probably one of the most challenging times for me that I remember just really vividly, and I knew this sickness was just lurking not too deep, just right below the surface, was I used to get to tour with a group, and I only got to tour with this group because my wife sung on this group. And I got to go along and, you know, fold up cables and put them in boxes and put lights away. And, you know, I was used to being in front of people. That's usually my role. And here, and Donna just was singing with this group, and it was beautiful, the things that were happening. But at the end of this first night that I got to go along, and roll cables, there were people just, you know, flocking to this stage area and, you know, loving Donna. And it was a lot, you know, of soldiers and other sorts of people around, and they're, you know, they're giving Donna kisses and handing her flowers. And I'm just sort of standing back there, and, you know, I wanted to hold the cable up that I'd wrapped so neatly and go, you know, did anyone see how neatly I rolled this? Isn't someone going to come to me and go, now that is amazing? But something in me wanted to be the one that people were going, oh, Tim, we love you. That's great. You know, the way you carry that ladder is phenomenal. You know, something in us wants to climb to the top of the pile. Something in us likes it when our name gets mentioned. I wonder when you ever look at group photographs, who's usually the first person you look for? Just we'll leave that one to the side. Is it about my recognition, or is it about God's glory? And if we are followers of Christ, then we trust that God has imparted gifts to us for service of His name and His glory. What are we doing with them? And I realize this duplicity in me so often. You know, I want to go to 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4 and 5, because even Paul, who wrote most of the New Testament, I believe somewhere he struggled with this, because he says this, my conscience is clear. Like, I've laid this stuff before God. My conscience is clear, but that's not going to make me innocent. It's the Lord who judges me, therefore judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait till the Lord comes. Goes on to say, He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness. And He will expose the what? The motives of men's heart. And at that time, each will receive his praise or his due from God. So Paul writes here, he goes, look, as far as I know, I've laid this before God. My conscience is clear, but I know that's not going to leave me innocent. Because God's going to know the motive behind everything that I did. And that's what He's going to call to account. I find it challenging. The second thing that we need to get a hold of is this, is we got to learn what it is to think of others first. It doesn't come naturally to us. Our human nature is self-serving. It so often comes down to it's about me. And so we've got to come to this place that we do think of others. Philippians chapter 2, Paul wrote this, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or vain conceit." Look at those two themes there. Let nothing be done out of selfish ambition or vain conceit or pride or positioning or letting it be about me. Don't let anything be done. It's better not to do than it be done about you. Instead, let each of us look not only to our own interests, but the interests of others. If we go back to Matthew chapter 20, where these two boys with mums step up and go, "Hey, this is about us. This is our time. I know that you just said that all this is going to happen to you in Jerusalem, but this is our time. And we want to secure that position with you in heaven." And that statement, when those boys take on that self-service, it causes an immediate dissension amongst 12 people that have walked together for the last 3 years. Immediately. And self-centeredness truly is the seed of dissension. In Proverbs chapter 6, there's a list, and I refer to it fairly often. 6 things God hates, 7 detestable to him. And the last one is this: a person who stirs up dissension amongst brothers. God hates dissension. But self-centeredness will always stir up dissension. God's heart is unity. And you can't have unity where everyone's heart is turned to themselves. That becomes just a kingdom of one. It's about the body. It's about the community. It's about the fellowship of followers of Jesus. And our self-centeredness isolates me and immediately stirs up dissension amongst brothers. Their reaction is this: they're indignant. They are mad. If you need water, there's water here if you want to. I'll even pour it for you. Being the other centered person that I am. If we were really walking in an others first mentality, I don't think there'd be a lot of the quarrels, dissension that we find. And what does Jesus do? It's really interesting that the first thing Jesus does is not go after the motivation of their hearts. It's really interesting the things Jesus doesn't do here. He doesn't rebuke the disciples. He doesn't rebuke the two. He doesn't rebuke the mother. What he does is, it says, Jesus called them together. Jesus immediately senses the dissension. These two that have set themselves up above the others, the 10 who are there that are just fighting this anger and this like bitterness that's already stirring, the indignation against these two. It's also interesting that, being aware and already knowing what's going on in Judas's heart, he doesn't at this point go, "You're upset at them, what about you?" That would have been a prime opportunity. But instead, he pulls them together. You can almost, maybe you can't, but I sort of picture, you know, that whole huddle thing. I don't know if you've watched the football and watched the locker room before the State of Origin, but everyone, you know, they all sort of come in together, and it's this sort of call to, like, let's get on the same page. And it worked for New South Wales this last week. It was awesome. But anyway, they pull in and they get this huddle going, and all of a sudden there's this like camaraderie and this theme of unity, and Jesus calls the disciples together. And 10 of them gather around Jesus, and they've got their arms, and no one wants to touch James and John, and you know, they're sort of standing there like this, and Jesus is like, no. Come on, Peter, put your arm around James there. Come on, Bartholomew. Put it around John. Come on, all of us. A little tighter. Okay. I picture it like that. Maybe you don't. Maybe you think that's too casual, but it's in that setting. Jesus sort of goes, come on, close. You got to get this, guys. You got to get this. Because in just a little while, I'm leaving you and you guys are going to change. This one makes my voice sound funny. Craig, now I understand why. Jesus' reaction, he calls them together. The world's ways Jesus addresses here, he says, the world. They teach a principle of lording it over someone, of power playing people, of getting a position of manipulation over another. Their energy is spent on getting to the top, and so that when they get to the top, you get to boss someone around. You get to climb the corporate ladder so that you get the corner office and you get to tell people what to do. That's the model. And Jesus goes, not in this huddle, not in this camp, not amongst you. Not so with you. The third thing that we really need to do if we look through Matthew chapter 20 here is follow the example of Jesus. In verse 28 here, Jesus says, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life away. Not so with you. We should follow this example of Jesus. And the funny thing is that Jesus is our example. Hebrews 12, fix our eyes on Jesus, the author, the finisher, but he's also the motivation. It's also his words that he's going, come on, this is what it's about. So he's our model, he's our motivation. Jesus was never focused on keeping his position. If you look at Philippians chapter 2, it says this, that our attitude should be the same as that of Jesus Christ, who did not consider his position as part of the Godhead or his equality with God something that he had to grasp and hold on to. But he made himself nothing. He took on the nature of a servant. And he took on human likeness. And he served. In fact, if you go to John chapter 15, flip over there, and there's a great story recorded of Jesus and his disciples at a meal together. John 13. In John 13, it's just before the Passover feast. Actually, pause one second. I did want to read John 15, and then I want to skip to John 13. I just skipped a little thing on my notes here. In John 15, Jesus really sets this example. He says this, I've loved you even as my Father has loved me. This is verse 9 through 14. And Jesus says, remain in my love. When you obey me, you remain in my love, just as I obey my Father and remain in his. I've told you this so you'll be filled with joy. Your joy will overflow. 12, I command you to love one another in the same way that I love you. Verse 13 says this. How do you measure it?
The greatest love is shown when people lay down their lives for their friends. And then Jesus says, you're my friend if you obey me. Jesus says, love is about laying down our lives for others. The fourth thing we must do, and this is where we'll go into John chapter 13, is we must open our eyes to opportunities. We've got to open our eyes to opportunities. Now go to John 13, if you would. Verse 1 says, it was just before the Passover feast, and Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served. The devil had already prompted Judas to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he'd come from God and was returning to God and to God. And so he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist, poured water into a basin, and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Jesus takes on the role of a servant to his disciples, to his friends at this meal, and he takes off his outer garment, puts his towel on, bends down, and just begins to wash them. You notice Peter, right after Jesus' action, just he freaks out and he's like, no way, that's not your role. Don't, you should not be doing that. But what I want to go back is just a couple of verses, because this is what enabled Jesus to serve. Go to chapter 13, verse 3. It says, Jesus knew who he was. And Jesus knew his position in his Father. Look at it there. Jesus knew the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God, and that he was returning to God. So he got up and served. I love that bit. Jesus knew who he was in God. He knew that he'd come from God. He knew that he was returning to God. He knew that he was on track with the task. He knew who he was. So he got up and he washed feet. In our way of thinking, that seems so bizarre. It would be like, you know, knowing that, you know, he knew that he was the corporate executive. He knew that he had got to the top. He knew that he no longer had to take orders from anyone. And so he served. It just flies in the face of what a biblical model is. It's funny, in church contexts, the number of times people have said things to me like, you shouldn't be doing that, you're the pastor. That's backward thinking. My thinking is I should be doing it if I'm a pastor. I should be found carrying dishes. I should be found vacuuming a floor. I should be found at least willing to clean a toilet. No, I should be found doing those things. I should be cleaning a toilet. I should be. Because that's a model Jesus established. He knew who he was. He knew what the Father had given him and called him to do. And that is what liberated him to serve. And not just serve here. You know, this, to me, serving in a church family should go without saying. That you shouldn't even have to think about that. I want to take this outside of here. We should be the first to serve in our community, in our neighborhoods. We should be the first to serve someone who's struggling with a bag at the grocery store. We should be the first to, you know, help someone catch their dog that just got off the leash and is running down Mooloolaba Beach. We should be the first to just jump in and go, man, can I help? Can I do something? I love that about, you know, Pete Hannah. I love that about you. I love that where something comes up, he's like, we can do something about that. I can help with that. I'll be there. I'll gather some guys. We'll bring tools. We'll bring a trailer. It's one of the first people to respond and say, I'll do it. I loved this morning as I'm walking in. I say good morning, and I didn't check if I could say anything about this, so I won't use a name. I loved that as I'm walking in, here's this fella going over to the garden, and he's picking up broken glass and broken bottle, and he goes, oh, someone... I said, you know, how are you this morning? He goes, yeah, good. Someone smashed a bottle here last night, and so I'm just going to pick it all up. And I'm like, that's... The first motivation is to just not... Hey, where's Trev? So can someone get Trev to come out here and pick up this broken bottle? Where's someone that knows how to pick up glass around here? And here he is, just over there in the gutter, picking up someone else's broken bottle and taking care of it. I love that heart. I already talked about the guys. I love seeing that, and ladies that come in, but I really love seeing the men come in and wash dishes in the kitchen during the week. Just come in and volunteer. I love that. That's the example of Christ. And we should open our eyes to opportunities around us all the time. And if we're not naturally wired like that, you got to start asking God, really, ask God, let me see what you see. Let me be moved by what moves you. And I think we'll be amazed at what things we begin to see. The fifth thing here is we've got to choose humility. We've got to choose it. You can't serve from a distance. That's one of the things. You see someone drop a bag of groceries, you can't stand half a parking lot away and go, can I help you? I mean, from over here, is there anything I can do from where I'm standing? Oh, you need me to come there? Sorry. I mean, really, I would do something if I could do it from where I am. You know, that's crazy, isn't it? You can't serve from a distance. You've got to get involved. You can speak from a distance. You can give ideas from a distance. But you've got to get close to get your hands involved. It's interesting when Jesus in John 13 turns to Peter as Peter's going, you can't do this to me. Jesus says, unless I wash you, you're not going to have a part with me. You're not going to get this unless you let me serve you. You're not going to be moved by this unless you really see me engage in it with you. I don't think Peter ever forgot it. You know why? Because if you go to 1 Peter chapter 5, this is Peter's letter. It's Peter who writes this. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another, because God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. I wonder if the image that Peter has as he's writing that, where he says, each of you, clothe yourselves with humility, isn't the image of Jesus taking off his outer garment, wrapping a towel around him, and kneeling at Peter's feet and going, Peter, if I don't wash your feet, you're not going to get this. And Peter years later writes and he goes, here's something you got to get. You got to clothe yourself with humility. God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And the sixth thing is this. We got to be willing to take the initiative. We've got to be willing to be the first to respond. It's easier to wait for someone else, I know. But where we are able, we should be willing. You'll come across things that you can't do, you wish you could do, but it's a heart thing. Again, it's not just the activity. Remember the theme in the first 2 weeks, praise and worship? It's not just the activity, it's the heart that produces it. Prayer, you remember last week here? It was not about the ritual of just praying. It was the dependency and the heart cry that produces my communion with God. And this week, it's not just the activity of doing it. It's the heart turned toward Jesus that produces it. It produces a fruit. We just yearn to be humble and serve others. Don't wait for someone else. As we wrap up, I'll give you these four action points. So if you've got nothing else out of all this, here's four action points that we can take away from here this morning. In fact, right after service, you can kick straight into these. You don't need a degree. You don't have to understand a whole lot. Here they are. The first one is this: serve whenever you can. Whenever you can, serve. Not in the context of church. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a lifestyle that wherever there's an opportunity, serve. Secondly, serve wherever you can. Wherever. Yeah, you know, I've heard people say, well, you know, in church, well, we had this day and people signed up for different jobs and stuff. And, you know, quite honestly, in a group of followers of Jesus this size, there's not going to be enough rosters and tasks and things for us to do once, you know, a month or once every 6 months. Serve outside of here. And I know tons of people are. I just want to continue to encourage us in it. Serve whoever is in need. Whoever. Whenever, wherever, whoever, and be willing to do whatever. I'll never forget a young man named Ben Strait. As a 16-year-old, he challenged me very deeply in my heart. We took a group to do some service projects. And we were in a 10-story building that a group of the sort of hippie followers of Jesus that had they'd taken over in the inner city. And they were serving the homeless out of there and serving a lot of the really destitute community. And they opened up the top couple of floors of this building to just to the elderly and those who needed care. And we, one morning we were getting our work details and this fella Mike said, look, I don't know if any of you are going to be up for this job, but we've got a room. One of the elderly went on a major, major drinking binge. And locked himself away. And he locked himself away for a couple of days in there. And we've now had to put him in care, but this room, he threw up all over it. He urinated all over it. He defecated all over it. And before Mike had finished speaking, this 16-year-old kid, Ben, goes, I'll do it. I didn't even get a chance, and I'm, you know, maybe I was waiting for one of them. I mean, I don't know. But here's this kid Ben, and he goes, "I'll do it." He didn't even hesitate. He chucked on a pair of gloves, and he went into one of the vilest circumstances you could put someone in. Really, honestly, it was terrible. He just worked away at it till it was done. It's that willingness, whenever, wherever, whoever, and whatever. And it'll only come when we come to a place that we get intentional about our response to God. Jesus said, I came to serve. I came to be the servant of all. Romans 8, again, I quote it all the time. It says, God from the very beginning purposed that we would be conformed to the likeness of Christ. And so I know it's a challenge, and I encourage you to take it on today. I expect after this, if someone gets bumped and their coffee spills on the floor, there's going to be this hive of activity of people like diving on it. No, let me do it. I'll clean that up. You know, I'm sure it'll happen. I want us to take it on as a real, that's when we're going to see transformation. Let's fix our eyes on Christ. And I want to bring back to everything I was talking about. We're going to close with this song. And it's not just a song so we can sing. I like songs that have a heart cry to them. And so I wonder if we can't sing this with intentionality. Sharon, if you want to pull words up, it's a song called Jesus Be the Center. It just says, Jesus be the center. And then it goes into a verse that says, Jesus be my vision. Be the fire that burns in this heart. Be the wind in the sails. If you don't get artistic imagery, it's just saying, move me. You be the one that moves me. Be my vision, be my path, be my guide, be where I walk and show me the way to walk it. And so I wonder whether you want to sing or whether you want to just meditate on the words that'll come up, if you just want to think it through, if you're not a singer. But I pray that the things we've talked about in the last 3 weeks and we're going to move on to in two more about being intentional might be what connect you with this song. Can we do that together? If you want to sit, stand, it's up to you.